Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
Welcome back to the show, team. My name's Amelia, and today we have another awesome guest on the show, I think, on a topic that a lot of people are very passionate about. We have Holly Farnan, who is about 50% doctor, almost. So Holly is a bee ecologist PhD candidate. So welcome to the show, Holly.
Thanks so much, Amelia. I really love bees, so I'm always excited to talk about my work and just bees in general as well.
Fabulous. And I know for a fact that we have listeners who are incredibly passionate about bees as well. So it's a match made in heaven. Starting with, who knows if it's an easy question, but what is your job?
So I am a PhD candidate, and basically I look at threats to native bees, and I'm based in Cairns in far north Queensland in Australia. And in particular, I'm looking at bee hotels and testing whether they spread pathogens or increase parasitism and predation. And so I'm doing a research project with some field work and lab work as well.
Because bee hotels are, I don't know if they're so cool this year, but they were definitely like the shiny cool thing not that long ago. What made you ask that question?
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of like articles in the media and just like bee hotels being sold everywhere, and they're promoted as being really good for bee conservation. And we do have some scientific studies of them being beneficial to bees in very like urban areas or in areas recovering from bushfire where those natural nesting sites aren't available. When these bee hotels were designed, most of them were made without being like studied, or they didn't really consult scientists into like what should be included and not included and what size holes should be used. And so they're really promoted as being good for bees, but they could potentially be a form of bee washing, which is similar to greenwashing, where something's promoted as being really good and kind of becomes a trend, but it has like intentions behind it to make money or just become like really viral. And so I was really interested in testing whether there are actually some limitations to these bee hotels and whether they might actually have some negative impacts on bees.
I think that's really interesting, and obviously important. I love the phrase bee washing. That's amazing. Do you have any idea where bee hotels started?
So they have been around for a few hundred years. They first started in like agriculture and for taxonomy purposes. People used to just use really simple little bee hotels. They're also known as trap nests, just to study behavior of some important pollinators and taxonomy as well. But since then, they've become really popularized, and I'd say especially in the last few years, they've become very popular. And I even saw one in Coles the other day, so that's how easy they are to get your hands on. And you know, everyone wants to help the bees, and it feels like something really nice to do, to put a bee hotel in your backyard. And I think it's nice, but I think we just need to do some more research and make sure that we have a design that's actually beneficial to bees.
I can see how it could be bad pathogen-wise. Like, you know, bees don't have a shower before they go to bed. The next bee might share the bed, kind of thing. That sort of makes sense as like how you could easily share other illnesses. You mentioned predation, though. Are they like a location where the predators go, oh, we know that the bees hang out here, so this is like our little buffet now?
Yeah, exactly. So the bees that nest in these bee hotels, they're solitary bees, so they're not social bees like honeybees. And a solitary bee is a bee that basically lives alone, builds its own nest, provides nectar and pollen for the babies, makes little cells, and then closes it up and goes about its life. And so these are bees that would usually nest in, well, they nest above ground, and also there's a lot of ground nesting bees as well, but I'm looking at above ground nesting bees. And so these bees would nest in like existing cavities, so maybe like beetle burrows or dried out reeds and stems. And so in nature, these cavities would be quite far apart. But with bee hotels, we're really just artificially aggregating these bees to nest together. And so this could become like really easy for predators to spot. And they could just come along and have a buffet, just eat all of the baby bees, and also for parasitoids and parasites to spot as well. So they could be vulnerable to like tiny little parasitic wasps that get into the nest and eat all the provisions or eat the baby bees as well. Also things like mites. There's also some parasitic beetles as well. So there's lots of things that they could be vulnerable to, and potentially artificially aggregating them together is really propelling that.
Yeah, that's a lot of potentially bad things. That will make sense. You also mentioned like the size of the holes is important too.
Yeah, so the size of the holes, both the width and the depth, is very important for bees. So cavity nesting bees, they usually like a depth of around 10 to 15 centimeters and a width of anything between around 2 or 3 millimeters to 12 millimeters. It depends on the bee species you're trying to attract. But the hotels, bee hotels in Bunnings, for example, a lot of those, they aren't actually deep enough. And so this will really just encourage things like wasps and spiders to live in them instead of bees, because some bees are quite picky and want quite a deep depth. And I've noticed a lot of my bee nests have around 7 separate cells in them, and in each cell there's a baby bee. So if that depth isn't deep enough, then the bee won't be able to lay all her eggs and make her entire nest, so she just won't nest in it.
Okay. So how are you... That's actually way deeper than I would have thought a bee would want.
Yeah, it's a bit surprising. And I had to buy a very long drill bit to make my bee hotels deep enough.
Yeah, so how are you doing your research? Like, did you go out and buy all the different bee hotels and then construct your own, like, perfect ones? Or...
Yeah, so I opted for... I read a lot of the literature, particularly the Australian literature, which is quite limited, but there's some really good bee hotel studies out there. So I kind of chose parts of their study design that worked well and built my own bee hotels. And so my bee hotels are hardwood blocks, and they each have a cavity 14 or 15 centimeters deep. And I chose to go with 2 hole widths. I went with 6 millimeters and 8 millimeters. And I did a lot of piloting to determine what was most popular for the bees in my region. And so my actual study design, I'm testing whether artificially aggregating bee nests increases pathogen spread, predation, competition, and parasitism. And so to do this, I'm comparing 2 bee hotel designs. So the first one is an aggregator design where I've got my individual hardwood blocks, each with a cavity in them, and I've got 12 of them bundled together. And then I'm comparing that with a dispersed design. So it's the same 12 blocks, but instead of being bundled together, they're each dispersed 1 meter apart on stakes. And so I've got a field study set up an hour south for Cairns in a tiny little area called Fishery Falls. And so my study is on sugarcane farms backing onto continuous rainforest, which is a very common context for a lot of eastern Australia and also tropical regions in the world. And so that will be running until around February, which will be just over a year in length. And I go out each month and sample all of the nests that have been capped off. And then I put them in glass vials and bring them back to the lab. And then I rear them and check them every few days and then preserve all of the insects that emerge. And then I also dissect the nests as well and record things like number of cells and if there's any hosts that didn't emerge, if there's any parasites, if there's any mold spores. And then I freeze those nests for later and I'll conduct some molecular identification and hopefully identify some of the species that I can't do using like morphological measurements, and also test for the bee pathogens and look at the mold spores and things like that as well.
That sounds really intense. That is a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. I actually just came out of the lab. I've just finished dissecting my February round of nests, which was 120 nests, and the January round was 137 nests. So now I'm on to March and it's currently June, so it is a lot of work, but hopefully I'll get there in the end.
I mean, those numbers sound good though. That sounds like a lot of nests.
Yeah, there is a lot of nests, and I especially had some interesting things happen at the beginning of my study. A month after I set it up, there was a cyclone, tropical cyclone Jasper, and then some really intense floods in Cairns as well. And so I was worried that my study would get washed away or blown away, but luckily it all stayed up. But because of that, I was able to capture some really interesting like nesting behavior of things like ants that would usually nest in the ground. Some of them crawled up into my bee hotels, and that could possibly be as a result of the wet weather. But yeah, I'll have to look more into that.
I mean, there's a lot of things you were talking about doing that I've never thought about before. And I think hand rearing a bee, that sounds like hard work.
So it does sound like hard work, but it's actually pretty easy because I take the whole nest out. I should add that in all of my bee hotels, I added cardboard straws into all of the holes. So the nests are built inside the straws, and then I just remove the straw and put it in a vial. And so inside the nest, the bees, they already have all of their food and everything they need. So they'll just eat their food and go through their different stages and pupate and then emerge as an adult. So I don't really have to feed them or anything. They just naturally go through the cycle, which is great.
Okay, that sounds a lot less challenging than trying to like feed a baby bee.
It would be very cute, but potentially very tricky.
Yes. Are there solitary bees like all over the world, or is that special to Australia?
There are definitely solitary bees all over the world. And so in Australia, we have around 1,600 to 1,800 species of bee, and only 11 of those are actually social, and that's our stingless bees from the genuses Tetragonula and Australoplebia. And then so the rest of the bees are solitary. And then in the world, I'm not exactly sure how many social species we have, but overall there's around 20,000 species of bee in the world, so a lot of those are solitary.
We are just so conditioned to be thinking of them as social.
Yeah, I think everyone is. Everyone's always talking about the honeybees, and if you're lucky, someone might know about bumblebees as well, but there's so much more to bees than those two.
Yeah. I know it's early in your research and you haven't done the analysis yet. Is there, do you feel like there's any advice you could give people who are thinking about doing bee hotels?
Yeah, so I definitely have some advice, and specifically, like for in the tropics, I would make sure you have a good roof for your bee hotel so it's not getting wet during the wet season. And you want the bee hotel to get some morning sun, but then preferably be a bit protected in the afternoon. You don't want it to be hot all day. And ideally use native timber if you can, and make sure that the hole sizes are recommended sizes. That's 10 to 15 centimeters deep, and then around 3 to 12 millimeters wide, depending on the species in your area. And in terms of whether we should be aggregating the bees, it's a bit early to say, but I would probably suggest to make a few smaller bee hotels with less holes and kind of spread them apart. And I'd also say just the best thing you can do if you want to help the bees is to maintain natural habitat. And you can do this by not cutting down trees and plants if you don't have to. And if you do, maybe leave a little pile of wood or something in the corner of your backyard. That's really great habitat for bees and also other animals and insects. And also make sure you plant lots of native flowers for the bees, because they get hungry too.
It sort of sounds like supporting the natural environment is probably better bang for buck than buying something pre-canned from Bunnings.
Absolutely. And it's really easy to make bee hotels as well, and you can do it with family or friends. If you do want to make your own, look for some old wood or native timber, but certainly preserving the natural habitat is the best thing that you can do. And also another thing with some of the hotels, like the ones from Bunnings, they are made overseas, and so they could be sprayed with insecticide when entering the country. And they could also be made from treated pine timber to protect against termites. So those really aren't good for bees at all.
Definitely feels like something you could very easily be misled into thinking you're helping and just making things slightly worse.
Yeah, 100%.
That's a bit disappointing. What does an average day at work look like for you?
It really varies for me, which I love. I love to do different things every day. So I do a lot of lab work, looking under the microscope and dissecting my nests, also pinning insects and identifying them to species. I do my field work once a month, which is always really fun. I went out the other day and I'm going out again next week. And I also work part-time as an entomology research technician for a company that looks at sugarcane. And so I work on the pest and biosecurity management team. So I do that once a week as well, which is really interesting. And then I also do a lot of writing and apply for my own grants and do professional development workshops and try and get my papers published and things like that. So, yeah, it really varies.
Yeah. The pest and biosecurity stuff sounds interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. So I mainly work on the greyback cane grub, which is a major pest to sugarcane. So their larvae eats the roots of sugarcane. And so we're investigating some alternative pest control treatments, because currently there's only one insecticide registered to control them. And that insecticide is actually quite bad for things like bees and also water invertebrates. And it's actually been banned in a few other countries already. And so we're trying to come up with some alternatives that are a bit better for the environment.
Is there a lot of like putting the grubs in a bowl and then pouring the poison on them and see what happens?
It's not quite that brutal. We do like plant experiments and things like that. But yeah, it's not quite that brutal.
This is why you have experts doing these things. Yeah. How interesting. That's a very interesting combination of things. It's kind of cool that you get to be working on like frontier research, but then also seeing how it applies to industry.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoy the mix of academia and industry as well. And I think you get to learn a lot on the ground in industry, which is really cool.
Yeah. How have you ended up like falling in love with bees and bee hotels?
So I think I always liked insects as a kid. I had lots of insect-themed outfits like lady beetle beanies and umbrellas and gumboots. But I actually wanted to study marine biology, and I kind of started studying that at James Cook University, but then I changed to study zoology ecology because I just found that really interesting. And then so in my third year of my Bachelor of Science, got to do a placement which was 130 hours in the insect ecology lab at James Cook University, which is the same lab I'm still a part of now. And that was working on a project which looked at pathogens and insecticide impacts on stingless bees. And then from that, I was really interested in bees, and I did my honours, which is a postgraduate degree where you do research for a year. And I tested the combined effects of insecticide exposure and heat stress on stingless bees. And I actually found that there was a big effect on stingless bees, and I've recently published that work in the Journal of the Royal Society Open Science last November.
Congratulations, that's
thank
awesome.
Thank you, my first paper. It took ages to write, but I'm glad it's finally out there.
Sorry.
And then from there, I worked at CSIRO in Brisbane on a project where I looked at testing whether insects could digest plastic. That I was there for around 3 months because it was just the end of a project and the funding was, it was the last bit of funding. So I just kind of did the last bit, which was really fun. And then I moved back to Cairns and worked as a horticulture technician on cocoa for a few months, and then moved into a job at James Cook University looking at ants and other invertebrates and sorting them. And then I got a full-time job at Sugar Reef working on the cane grub project. And so I worked there full-time for a year and a half. And then I was just really inspired to go back to academia and do my PhD. And so now I just work at Sugar Research one day a week. And yeah, my life pretty much revolves around bees at the moment.
That sounds like a really sort of like balanced journey all up though.
Yeah, I think I've been like pretty lucky to get the opportunity to have like so many experiences and different jobs. Like I've already had 5 jobs in the industry and I'm only 24, so I feel like I've been very fortunate and especially very lucky to not have to go back to like a casual job in hospitality or retail. So yeah, I'm pretty lucky, I think.
I think getting to do related stuff to your work makes such a difference.
It definitely does.
What did they find with the plastic and the bugs eating the plastic? Does it work?
I'm not exactly sure the details, but I did see that CSIRO made a post about it on Instagram the other day. So if people are interested, go check that out.
I missed that one. Also, I realise we have forgotten to define, what is a pathogen?
That's a good thing to define. So a pathogen can be like fungal or bacterial, and it can be transferred from organism to organism. And then whether it causes an infection or not is a different story, but yeah, it has the potential to.
Okay, so a pathogen may be transferred to another organism but won't necessarily make them sick.
Yeah, and in bees pathogens can be fungal or bacterial, and a lot of honeybee pathogens can be spread to solitary bees as well.
Do we have our own like native pathogens and bacteria for our native bees? Like,
yeah, so we definitely do, but whether or not they've been researched is a different story. I've done a lot of kind of searches in the literature and can't really find too much about different pathogens, but certainly there would be a lot out there. We just need some more research to identify them. But yeah, definitely some out there.
Do these native solitary bees, this is a bit of a harsh question, but are they useful, like, to the economy?
So the value that they provide to, like, ecosystem services is just very, like, you can't put a price on it. They maintain a lot of ecosystems and obviously pollinate a lot of native plants, and they can also be really good garden pollinators. A lot of the buzz pollinators, like blue-banded bees, they're really good at pollinating tomatoes and eggplants and cucumbers. And there are some researchers working on harnessing native bees for pollination of crops. I know there's some stuff happening on berry pollination in New South Wales, and I think also some stuff testing greenhouse pollination. But solitary bee, like harnessing solitary bees for pollination in agriculture, it isn't really a huge industry in Australia yet, I would say. But overseas in America, a lot of solitary bees are used for pollination of crops like apples, and it's really popular.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I'm sure someone else would know a lot more about that than me.
I am asking you tricky questions outside of your research, so I appreciate you giving it a shot. What is something cool about your work that helps you get up in the morning and be excited to look at 140 bee nests?
So I'd say the coolest thing is going to check my bee hotels in the field and never knowing what I'm going to find, and then also checking the nests once they're in the temperature cabinet being reared. I've found like some really cool parasitic wasps and parasitic beetle, which is probably the coolest thing I've found so far, and like some different bee species that may or may not be new species of bees. I've got a talk to some expert taxonomists about that. But yeah, just always finding something cool is my favorite thing.
I do feel like that is a bit of a risk in Australia, is if you put a small hole out there, something will crawl into it.
Definitely. And I see, yeah, all sorts of holes that are just filled with wasp nests and things like that, and I think insects are just really good at scoping out potential nesting holes, and they'll get into just about anything.
You did say parasitic beetle. Is that a thing?
Yeah, so I had only read about them in the literature until a month ago when I found one. And so the one that I found is from the family, I think it's pronounced Rippiphoridae, and this beetle, it has like a particularly interesting life cycle. So the eggs of the beetle are usually laid on flowers or somewhere where they're likely to come into contact with an adult bee. And then once the beetle larvae hatch, they are a very hyper mobile, active little demon larvae thing called a triungulin. And so they will attach them, like launch onto bees and cling on and get taken back to the bee nest, and then they'll scurry into the nest and scope out the bee larvae, and then they'll burrow into the bee larvae's body and they'll go through their second phase of life as an endoparasitic larvae. So they'll go inside the bee larvae and basically eat its organs and all the fat, but just enough so that they can grow. And then I'm not sure if they completely kill the larvae or not, probably. And then they'll come out of the larvae and they'll finish their larval life as an ectoparasitic larvae, where they'll then consume the rest of the larvae that they didn't eat. and then they'll pupate and turn into a beetle and the life cycle starts all over again. So it's very, a very brutal world out there.
You look at flowers and you're like, oh, they're so pretty and restful and like they smell nice and, you know, there's parasitic beetle babies just waiting.
Just waiting for their prey.
How big did the beetles get?
So the one that I got was probably 1.5 centimeters long. I'm not too sure how big they can get, but it was actually, it's a very cute beetle that has these long, fluffy antennae, and it's got a metallic-y orange shell, so you wouldn't expect it to be so evil.
It does sound just so grim.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so many, like, leaps in evolution have had to happen. Or not leaps, but, like, that's a really creative evolution. So instead of the beetle being like, I'll just eat this leaf, it's been like, let's go off on this journey of eating the inside of an unborn bee.
Yeah, definitely. It's so, so fascinating finding out, like, different life histories of parasites and parasitoids and how they've evolved to target different food sources.
Yeah. Just because it's small doesn't mean it's friendly. Not at all. Thank you for sharing.
That's okay.
Is there any advice that you wish you could give younger you?
Advice that I would give younger me, as in me last year, would be...
It can be. It doesn't have to be that much younger.
Yeah, probably to not worry so much about designing the perfect experiment. And my ideas have changed a lot over the course of a year and a half. And I would just tell myself that things don't have to be 100% perfect. And I'm still going to find something interesting, even if things change from what I originally wanted to do.
I feel like that's good advice, not just for science.
Yeah, I think you can take that from any angle.
Yeah, no, I think that's lovely. And what about myths? Are there any myths or misconceptions that you bump into when you tell people what you do that you would like to take this opportunity to squash?
Yeah, so I would say that the biggest myth I constantly hear is that we need to save the honeybees. So honeybees are actually introduced to Australia, and the populations worldwide, the managed populations, are actually increasing rather than decreasing. And a lot of attention is put on honeybees, but really it's the thousands of other bees that actually may be declining and need our help, and they're really understudied. And honeybees actually threaten native bees as well in Australia, and that's through means of resource competition and also spreading pests and diseases to native bees.
No one wants to hear that about a honeybee.
Yeah, they're so cute. But the amount
tasty,
of,
not
yeah,
the, bee,
the amount of things I see saying save the bees with a picture of a honeybee, so many.
Actually, I have a mean question. Do you have a favourite bee?
Favourite bee? I would say my favourite bee at the moment is a leafcutter bee, in particular a species found in far north Queensland called Utricheria. I don't know how to say it. I don't think anyone does, but
I'm not going to tell you off.
Yeah, they're just a really cute little bee, and they cut out little circles of leaves and use that to line their nests, and they're just really sweet. And the males and the females look different. The females are white and black striped, and then the males have fluffy golden and black stripes, and then the males have cute little green eyes as well. And I always see them in my garden, and they are my most common occupant in my study, so I have to give them some credit.
And after hearing about that beetle, like, that sounds like a really nice passive kind of vegetarian way of living.
Exactly. Be like a leafcutter bee.
Yeah, that's really lovely. And I think, yeah, save the bees has sort of got a little bit out of control. Yeah. Is there anything else we haven't touched on that you'd like to share?
I would just like to give a little shout out to my PhD supervisor, Professor Laurie Locke from James Cook University. Been working with her for quite a few years now, and I actually did my placement in my bachelor in her lab and then got inspired to do my honours, and then I also worked for her and now I'm doing my PhD. And she has probably been my biggest inspiration, and she always drives me to be the best scientist I can be, and she just works extremely hard yet still always has time to give me advice and support. So I really appreciate her.
That sounds like everything you want in a supervisor.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm pretty lucky.
Fabulous. So high fives to you, Professor Laurie, for helping out Holly and getting you doing this awesome research. It's fantastic.
Cool.
And with that, I'd just like to thank you for coming on the show and for sharing about the wonderful things that critters do and the terrifying things. And I wish you absolutely the best luck for the next year and a half and a bit of your PhD. Hope it goes really well. Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee, head to avidresearch.com.au and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.